Hi, Todd Feinberg, After Six. It's Michael Leibowitz time. He is our buddy who's a prisoner and a political philosopher and a thinker and fun to talk to. And with all this Epstein stuff going on, it's a perfect time to check in with Mike and find out what kind of reaction somebody who's lived the last 22 years of his life in a prison cell, what kind of reactions he has when he hears a story like this Epstein thing. Hey there, Mike. Thanks for being here once again.
Hey, Todd.
So what was your reaction when you heard about Epstein having been killed or committing suicide, whatever?
Okay, first of all, there has been absolutely nothing that's been reported that has surprised me in the least bit. Not the guards sleeping on duty, not guards missing tours, not guards filing false logs. That, in my experience, is par for the course.
That's standard procedure for you.
Yes. I mean, I don't want to say it's every guard on every shift. I just mean it's common enough that over the last 22 years, I've seen it happen more than a couple handfuls of times.
And the importance of this situation. So I can see what you're saying on a routine basis. Like, you look at Connecticut, you look at the prison system, it's in the background. They've got a opaqueness between them and the public, and they can do whatever they want unless a scandal breaks out. But when you look at a prisoner of this high profile who attempted suicide a couple weeks before his death and was only on suicide watch briefly, it all, from the outside, it looks insanely incompetent.
Oh, it's insanely incompetent. It's just that, you know, a lot of people have like these conspiracy theories, and it takes no conspiracy. They are this incompetent. In fact, I mean, I would love to throw a challenge out to any DOC official that may be listening, and, you know, maybe your listeners can petition for it. They should ask to just view one day in any block that has cells in it, in any jail in this state, and watch the COs when they do their tours. They can pick it at random, and you'll see they most of the time do not even look in the cells. I heard you say, well, they should have buttons. Well, at McDougal, where I came from, they did. And what the COs do is they walk around, hit the button, and keep going. But they don't bother looking in.
Except...
Even that doesn't work.
Well, you know, you do need administrators. So the thing is, if you're walking around hitting a button, you're also responsible for making sure that whatever is supposed to be okay at that moment is okay. And maybe maybe those guards are able to tell everything's okay simply because they were there, but at least the button gets them there. These guys, maybe, I mean, we don't really know what happened yet, but maybe these guys were asleep.
Oh, it wouldn't surprise me, not in the least bit. And that kind of is a good segue into, you know, the main thing that I really wanted to discuss is the failure of corrections officials or spokespeople to take responsibility for anything that happens. I mean, you see the union's response to this. Well, you know, we're understaffed, we're underfunded. And it was a similar response in Connecticut when there were six guards caught on tape at Gardner Correctional Institution sleeping, full-blown, knocked out and sleeping, were photographed. Between 2010 and 2015, 300 guards were either arrested or had warrants out for their arrest. And when News Channel 8 did a story on it, the response was, well, you know, our guards are stressed out. Maybe we need to have a discussion about that. When the COs escaped from, where the hell did they escape from now? Carl Robinson in Cheshire, it was, you know, this is not indicative of how our staff are. And then 12 former COs were under investigation or indicted, I'm not really sure, for running a Ponzi scheme, and it was the same thing. This is not indicative of the good men and women that work for the Department of Correction.
You're talking about union statements, right? I mean...
Yeah, well, ultimately, well, not just union, but the spokespeople. And the irony of ironies here is that people in general in society, I think, and rightfully so, want criminals to own up to their conduct, to take responsibility for what they've done and change their behavior. But our captors don't have to do that, it seems. They get a free pass.
Yeah, so that's a fair enough point. You are in the middle of a political organization, and two political organizations, the state and the union, and they kind of dance with each other in this con game that they play on the people. So in a way, it's a little different because what they're really trying to do is make sure that the people who pay for the services they provide and the people whose power they are making use of in operating a government and operating a prison system. They want to make sure we don't know what's going on, so they're just throwing up the usual smoke screen so that we remain in the dark. And while your point's a valid one, I think it's a more complicated situation than them just failing to own up. They're deliberately trying to throw up smoke screens so that nobody sees what's going on.
Yeah, that's kind of what I meant by not taking responsibility, is that they don't publicly own up to it, so they don't ultimately have to make any changes. There's always an excuse. And, you know, like you said, it's a government organization. They're protected by unions, and so they get away with it. And I heard you say that you were sure some fall guy would be fired or some such thing, and I got to tell you, I'm not so sure. And I think I saw that two of the guys were reassigned and the warden was reassigned.
Yeah.
And there's a pending investigation. But often it seems to me what happens, as with the six officers that were asleep, is what they said was, yeah, we're going to investigate this. But then the story loses steam or on to the next thing and you never hear another thing about it and nobody's held accountable. Now, in our book, Brent McCall and I, we actually documented crimes committed by people that work in the industries program at McDougal, verifiable crimes. Nobody was ever held accountable, and no investigator ever spoke to a single inmate that I'm aware of, not even McCall or me. Now, their claim would, of course, be, well, you can't ask the inmates because they're unreliable. But that is kind of silly to me, because whenever a street criminal commits a crime, they go to other street criminals to testify against them. And in fact, if criminals were so unreliable, the place would be virtually empty without other criminals cooperating.
Yeah, that's not... You've just pointed out a huge discrepancy in that excuse. That's not very realistic for them to claim. As a matter of fact, it's laughable for them to make that excuse for why they can't have witnesses. They even keep... I mean, everybody knows the stories, but they keep criminals out of prisons because they do such a good job at continuing a life of crime and reporting to police about what they're up to.
Yeah. Now, what we had documented was industry staff putting pressure on inmates to slow down to steal overtime. Now, like I said, you would have to ask inmates in that situation. You would think, right? I mean, you know, is this happening?
Wait, describe that for us a little less quickly. What exactly is the scam?
Okay, so say a job comes in to do countertops for UConn. You know, UConn College, right?
Okay, I didn't know the prison did that kind of work. That's great.
Yeah, oh yeah, all types of stuff like that. So say you could knock it out in 2 hours. Well, the staff member would say, hey, make this one take, you know, 4 or 5 hours. Instead of two. And, you know, you do that over and over and over again, and you end up with a whole lot of overtime.
Yep.
And, you know, nobody's ever said to me, or, you know, well, inmates are unreliable, but it just seems to me that would be the excuse. I can't think of any other for why no inmate was ever interviewed about it.
Well, this is the thing about what happens in political systems is the political systems get converted into servicing the political organization that's in charge of them rather than taking care of the people's business. And, you know, this is a tragedy of government, and I don't know if there's a way to get around it. I don't know if there's a way to avoid it and make it so government actually feels a responsibility to produce, and to produce like that money is precious that's being spent, instead of that they've got their own little private enterprise where they get to scam the taxpayers. And it's a real dilemma and a real challenge to figure out how to solve it. We're talking with Michael Leibowitz. He is a prisoner in the state system, and he joins us every week to talk about any number of topics, but we're reacting to Jeffrey Epstein's death a little bit and getting Michael's input on prison life. So what else along those lines, Michael, can you tell us about that would give people a sense of how it sounds like there's no type of nefarious behavior inside of a prison that you wouldn't see?
No, I mean, nefarious is almost too tough of a word, because it really is just indifference and incompetence. Now, that in itself you might call nefarious, don't get me wrong, but I just, when I think nefarious, I think of some kind of intention.
Right.
And I just think that it's what results when the incentives are not there for somebody to do a good job. If the two COs that were supposed to be watching Epstein, if the mortgage on their house getting paid depended on them keeping him alive, you can bet they would have kept him alive.
Yes.
But the problem is, they know there's no consequence. They're going to get paid regardless. And it goes beyond just keeping him alive. I mean, you and I have talked in the past about the 60% recidivist rate in Connecticut. In some states, it's even higher than that. But there's no incentive to reform offenders. They're going to get paid no matter what. And if you want to change that, you have to change the dynamic of how they're incentivized. You need to make their pay in some means dependent on the results that they get. I mean, it's just ridiculous. Any job where you're going to pay somebody, no matter how good the job gets done, you're going, and then you give them a union on top of it, you're going to end up with a job poorly done. I mean, don't you think?
Yeah, and I don't know what the solution is. So the natural thing would be you privatize this stuff and you have very strict guidelines on how the private organizations are supposed to operate, and you hold them to strict standards and you don't let them stay in business. But we know that there's already an argument out there saying you can't trust private prisons to run properly because they're all in bed with the politicians, and you know, so I'm not sure where you find a clean solution to trying to have a government at all.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up. I've told you that I'm working on a plan to reduce mass incarceration and crime. Part of that is to partially privatize the prison system. Now, there's actually a company, it's called the Serco Corporation, S-E-R-C-O, and they operate private prisons in Australia, New Zealand, and I believe in the United Kingdom. And they actually administer bonuses based on a reduction in the recidivist rate. Now, the way that the prisons, the private prisons in America have worked is they get paid based on the amount of people that are occupying beds. So the incentive in that case is not to reform offenders, it's to keep offenders behind bars. Not that, you know, they would go out of their way to keep them in there, but it's just not a good incentive to have. Whereas the Serco company that I'm talking about, their incentive is actually to reduce recidivism and to reduce crime. And from what I understand, they've had pretty good results thus far.
So what they're paid for what exactly on a per-prisoner basis?
In America, the private prisons are paid based on how many inmates occupy their beds.
So that creates a perverse incentive? The prison wants to make sure that these prisoners stay forever?
Yeah, so that's there. But
you have 1 minute left.
In the Australia prison, which I'll tell you about when I call you right back, I'll get to it.
Okay, we're talking to Michael Leibowitz. He's on the prison phone. Because that's the only way we get to communicate with him, and that's why you hear the sound effects and the talking computer voice that limits all calls to 15 minutes. Continuing now with Michael Leibowitz. Michael, so we were talking about a private prison operation. I think it looks like they're based, Serco is based maybe in the UK.
I believe it is.
And so how do they structure the prison incentives so that they're not incentivized to do bad things but good things?
Well, the one part of it that I know, and I haven't been able to really study their, you know, administrative structure in depth, but I have a little bit, and I know that they award bonuses based on reductions in recidivism.
Mm-hmm.
So the incentive is there to actually reform offenders.
Yeah. But that would require that you have a really good system in place, which I guess is, from what I've read of your book and learned talking to you, that really what's missing in our system is a system that is preparing prisoners to go back into the outside world and to not commit crimes again, but to find a new path. And that's a really difficult thing, don't you think?
It is a difficult thing, but between the success of the Serco Corporation and their incentive structure and the abundance of evidence out there as far as what types of correctional practices work to reduce recidivism, there's really no excuse not to have a better working system. And the shame of this whole thing is that if it were me that ended up dead in a cell, you wouldn't probably have heard anything about it. The only reason people even know about this is because it was Jeffrey Epstein. You know what I mean? So imagine how many times this sort of thing is happening in prisons across this country that you just never learn about.
I did hear a conversation, too, that was related to Jeffrey Epstein, where they were talking about the problem of certain types of prisoners. Like, if you look at the profile of Jeffrey Epstein, but take away maybe the filthy rich and connected to powerful people, but just somebody who's lived an upper middle class affluent lifestyle, and suddenly they're swept into a situation they'd never anticipated. You know, they maybe committed crimes to get themselves there, but they didn't think they were going to get caught and end up in this situation. And like Epstein, you know, somebody made the point where we were having a conversation about Epstein's death. They said, well, it couldn't have been suicide because he'd already been incarcerated before. Well, the first time he was incarcerated, he was not really incarcerated. He could use his leverage to make it a cushy situation. This time it was clear they were locking him up and throwing away the key, the crimes they were going to bust him on, and the built-up demand for him to finally face the music after he got an easy ride down in Florida. Well, this meant he was in prison realizing that everything he valued in life was gone. I mean, this was a guy who reportedly wore a new shirt once and then threw it away. He didn't bother washing them. And if you think about going from that status to being in a suicide watch or in the SHU, it's just hard to imagine that you wouldn't get depressed really quickly. And it turns out this is what happens, that at least that's what these people were saying, that when people get locked up and they're in this situation for the first time and they don't know how to handle it and they're shocked with how they've lost all control over their lives, that the normal thing is to get really depressed and to want to commit suicide, and happens at a very high rate, they were saying.
You make a good point, and I actually frequently have a debate in here with a friend of mine who wants me to discuss this issue of how being locked in a cage for 22 hours a day affects a person. I don't normally like to discuss it from that angle because I understand that there's a possible perception of bias on my part to complain about stuff like that, so I kind of steer away from it. But there is, you know, some validity to it, that you take somebody and lock them in a cage for 22 hours a day, or 23 in some cases. And yes, it's very depressing, and some people simply can't handle it, especially when they're not being supplied with, you know, programming to do or education to do, something to occupy them in a productive way. You know, you're just thrown in there, and it's very plausible that that could lead to a Jeffrey Epstein-type situation.
All right, so Michael, we just have a minute left. Tell us what else occurred to you and is running through your mind with all this focus in the general public on prisons and how they're managed.
Well, I'm just very happy. I mean, I'm not happy the guy died despite what he did, but I'm very happy that something like this has brought the public's attention to this issue. And listening to you talk about it, and I think you hit the nail right on the head about it being typical government incompetence. And I think that that's where conservatives can get involved and look at prison reform. And I think liberals a lot of times already want to reform the prisons. So it makes for a kind of a perfect storm to bring attention to an issue that I care deeply about. And again, if anybody wants to know how the prisons run, read Down the Rabbit Hole, How the Culture of Corrections Encourages Crime by Brett McCall and Michael Leibowitz.
Yes, that is the book, Down the Rabbit Hole, and it's a privilege for us, Michael, to get to talk with you and get the first-hand perspective on all kinds of things in life, all aspects of life, when you're living the life that you are.
Thank you very much, Todd, and thanks again for having me.
Thank you. We'll see you next week, Michael.
All right.
That's Michael Leibowitz. He joins us every week here on After 6.